Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of November. Monday at 9, it's All Things Political, and our guest this hour is Charles Peters, founding editor and former editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. The magazine has been way ahead of the mainstream press in covering stories of government and corporate abuse. He has pioneered what's sometimes called explanatory journalism, combining incisive reporting with pointed analysis. He has worked in theater, advertising, law, politics, and the federal government before coming to journalism. He writes a Tilting at Windmills column, and he is the author of a number of books, including How Washington Really Works, Blowing the Whistle, Dissent in the Public Interest, Inside the System, A New Road for America, The Neoliberal Movement. He has mentored number of very prominent journalists, including Jonathan Alter, James Fallows, and Michael Kinsley. And we have a lot to talk about. We'll start with some of what he writes in his current Tilting at Windmills column, which is a wide variety of very interesting areas of discussion. And we'll welcome phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you are going to send us an email, then you do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Charlie Peters, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Well, I guess we're going to get our fill of Sarah Palin this week.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
She is a physically attractive woman with few other virtues that I can see. I'm just amazed at the phenomenon.
Why do we stay with this story? I mean, it's all over the place, and it's going to continue all week long.
I think it's one of the great mysteries The parodies of her were so dead on, and you would have thought that would have been the end of it. But I think the Republicans are pretty desperate for some just interesting character. You know, I think they truly are. They are very short of talent, to put it gently.
Yeah. You we're still involved in healthcare reform. I thought you had some really pointed remarks when you talked about healthcare reform in your current column, that we need to reduce costs while improving care. You start with drug prices here, which we haven't concentrated on a whole lot as we look at healthcare reform in the country. Why not give the government the power to negotiate prices with drug companies?
I think the cruel fact is the drug lobbies are so strong, and in this particular year, it is pretty well known around town that Rahm Emanuel, the White House, made a deal with the Billy Tosin, the chief lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry, to not have the government bargain for drug prices as a part of the support, getting the pharmaceutical industries to support the health reform bill.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed to me they darn near gave away the store in order to get that support. And I think the perilous danger in this bill is that Emanuel in particular has been notorious around Washington for just wanting a bill. At considerable sacrifice of the reform that really needs to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite disturbing, quite disappointing, because your listeners should understand that I'm almost a hopeless Obama fan. For 3 years I've been rooting for him, but I think he has the potential to be one of the greatest presidents of all time. I still think that, but there are some disturbing signs now and then, like Bud Geithner and Larry Summers and the deals they're making on the health care bill.
Yeah. And why do you see those disturbing signs? Is it that he feels he needs the experience of those people, or there are a lot of people disappointed that he's not making good on his promises?
On the health bill, it's more the comp. He in the Illinois state legislature, he was an effective compromiser because he he in the state legislature, the parties haven't been quite as ideologically partisan as they have been in the national Congress. So that in the state legislature, you could get Republican votes for decent measures. I remember when I was in the West Virginia state legislature, on some of the reform bills, I got a third of the Republicans supporting me. But in the current climate in Washington, that's a non-starter. The things have become so polarized, so that the spirit of reaching out to compromise bipartisanship that Obama so tried to emphasize when he came to power, it just doesn't work. So I think that had a lot to do with the approach, the seeking broad support for the bill, meaning you were trying to get some of the big lobbies to go along with you, and once you start doing that, you're in great danger of losing the soul of the bill.
Mm-hmm. So would you recommend that?
On the other hand, with Geithner and Summers, I think that it's more a problem it reminds me of I came to Washington with Jack Kennedy, and if Jack Kennedy had a weakness, it was for respect for super bright guys. And he liked there to be in the company of the super bright people, and sometimes those super bright people were wrong in their conclusions and policies, and sometimes I remember a great example in the Kennedy administration was there was a fellow named Chester Bowles, who was right on almost all the issues, but horribly dull to talk to. And, you know, he was one of those guys, if you got trapped with him at a party in a corner, you know, you were looking desperately for somebody, your wife to come or somebody to rescue you. And but Chad was right about the issues. But, well, Jack just couldn't stand being trapped in a room with Chad. So Chet was right about Vietnam. Chet was right about the Bay of Pigs, but Jack was listening to those real smart guys, you know. so that's the problem with people like Geithner and Summers. They're smart, but they're wrong. and their friends are on Wall Street, and even though they are modestly reform minded for Wall Streeters, that's the most modest kind of reform you could think of, because those guys are a different breed.
Yeah, Charlie, what about some kind of passage of health care reform? Would you advise the president to dump this 60 vote business and just go to reconciliation?
I was thinking of calling a. It's funny that this morning I was thinking of calling a friend in the Senate to ask him if there's any hope of getting around that 60 vote thing. It's funny, historically, your listeners may be interested to know that in the old days, when the filibuster was, you had to have 67 votes to break the filibuster. The filibuster was usually only used for on the civil rights measures. It was the South fighting the civil rights measures. But otherwise, you could pass a lot of progressive legislation passed under Franklin Roosevelt with less than 60 votes, with many less than the 67, because they just didn't, it wasn't considered something they would apply to issues other than civil rights. But once they reformed it, cut it down to 60, then gradually, as this polarization between the parties has occurred, it's now become you've got to get a 60-vote majority for practically anything,
right?
Which is crazy. I mean, and it's a great difference from history. It's an unnoticed product of this polarization.
Mm-hmm. Back to drugs for just a moment.
Yeah.
Before we go
sure.
to You know, I can't believe how much advertising there is for Viagra and other kinds of products like that. It's just in cholesterol-lowering drugs and, you know, they just dominate news, et cetera. You call for us to abolish or radically reduce drug advertising.
I think, you know, I mean, this is another fact of history. One thing about being an old man is that you remember some things that people just have completely forgotten. But as recently as 15 years ago, we didn't have drug advertising. It was forbidden, and for obvious reasons, you have people hearing about all these ailments and all these remedies, and they suddenly go to the doctor and they think they have to have this or they have to have that, and the doctors, you know, the doctors become complicit because they get these various forms of payoffs from the pharmaceutical companies, which are disgraceful. In themselves, but also the doctors just want to please their patients who come in and ask for the expensive pill. It's so crazy because, for instance, I take a generic statin instead of Lipitor, and the cost is infinitely less. It's a switch so easy to make. I remember there was a premium antacid. I've forgotten the name of it, but gosh, there was a commercial for it every hour, and it was very expensive. And so doctors were always prescribing it when there was one called Prilosec that was just as effective over the counter. They're just outrages like that, where the doctors, the pharmaceutical companies, become complicit, and when you throw in the advertising, giving people a sense that they have to have this particular drug for this particular ailment. Many of the ailments they hadn't even thought of before until they heard the ad. Then you get all this, the pressure on the doctor to give them the drug, coupled with the pharmaceutical companies
Right. Bribing
the doctors, and you've just got a hideous situation.
Yeah. Somebody told me that nobody's done, and maybe this is not true, maybe you've done this, a really extensive expose on the pharmaceutical industry since the 1950s. Is that true?
Well, I think we, the Washington Monthly, from time to time ran articles about some of the things that were wrong. One of the last ones we ran just before I left was how they have maneuvered the FDA over the years to get the largest part of the FDA budget spent on initial drug approval, and then almost nothing in the budget devoted to the follow-up of drugs to see what problems develop once they get into wide use. And, of course, that's been a terrible problem because many drugs develop dangerous side effects in once they get into use and kill people and everything else. But the FDA was for years, by design of the drug industry and the way that they affected their lobbying to reduce to keep the budget for follow-up studies by the FDA almost at nothing.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Charles, and we'll take them in a moment. Charles Peters, founding editor and former editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, is our guest this hour. He writes still, Tilting at Windmills, a column for the Washington Monthly. He was in the West Virginia legislature. He worked with Sergeant Shriver in the Peace Corps. He ran for his county, the John F. Kennedy campaign in 1960. He has worked in law as well, in advertising and in theater, and he is our guest this hour for All Things Political. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. the second hour of our program today. Peter Yarrow will be our guest from Peter, Paul, and Mary, the 60s folk trio. He has two new books, wonderful song collections. He, I understand, will bring his guitar as well, so should be a fun hour. We go to phone calls now. All things political. Charlie Peters, founding editor and former editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, founded 40 years ago, a little over 40 years ago. We go to Jim from Milwaukee, our first call. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk today about how the Republicans can manipulate people on national security issues and talk about Gitmo. And I'll introduce it by saying that on whatreallyhappened.com, if you look under Osama bin Laden, H.L. Mencken is quoted as saying the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamors to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. Well, in the Sunday Chicago Tribune, they had an article about a little town called Thompson, Illinois, where they have a maximum security prison, which is very much underutilized, and they want to consider using that for Gitmo detainees and putting them there. And the congressman there, named Manzullo, is a Republican who's on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And he said that, you know, jobs are important, but the national security trumps everything else. And he said he was concerned that Al-Qaeda would follow Al-Qaeda into northwestern Illinois. Now, you know, I would argue you can't even get Al Franken to go into northwestern Illinois, let alone Al-Qaeda. And anybody who is familiar with how any prison operates knows that a maximum security prison is very difficult to get out of, practically impossible, and that any inmate visitors, mail, they have to provide an address, and they have to have a phone number in the whole nine yards. And nobody's going to follow these people into northwestern Illinois or anywhere else because the security will prevent that. And so, but this con manipulating yokes people up and gets them to support the needless interventions that we have in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you want to end the abuse, you got to name the abuse.
Charlie.
Well, I totally agree with the, I think the success of the Republican of the conservative Republican propaganda machine, I have to say, has been like on the health bill. It is like they got a lot of old people really scared to death. Now on Afghanistan, they've got they're trying to panic Obama into making a decision. I want him to reflect before he does something because there's such a danger of making a horrible mistake. Yesterday, a man as supposedly as reasonable as David Broder wrote a column in the Washington Post saying it's time to decide, you know, and not doing nothing but reflecting, showing he'd been brainwashed by the Republicans. It's tragic you thought we'd won the election, but we haven't. These guys, I mean, it's scary. It's really scary the power of that conservative propaganda machine, and the power to subtly brainwash even supposedly liberal Democrats. It's scary.
Do you have any concerns, Charlie, about civil trials taking place in New York City?
No, I don't have the concern. I don't have the big concern that everybody else, that so many people seem to have. I don't really see what the big worry is. If assuming the government has the evidence they say they have.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the president is looking for? He's had four recommendations concerning Afghanistan. He wants some more. What's he looking for?
Then you thought all the recommendations were in, and then you read last week that the ambassador was saying, which you hadn't heard before,
right,
that the ambassador was there, who's a former lieutenant general in the United States Army was saying, don't send more troops, don't send more troops, because this guy Karzai is a crook, and you got to have some incentive for him to straighten up. And if you support him without demanding that he straighten up, you're crazy, because it's just going to. I'm doing a book right now on Lyndon Johnson, and what this reminds me so much of, it's almost haunting the way it reminds you of the pressures on Johnson to escalate in Vietnam. It was the same kind of thing, you know, coming down to the implication that you're a gutless coward if you don't do this. And all the military told him that he had to do it, all the military. So today people say, you should listen to your military advisors. Well, the military advisors were dead wrong.
Right.
Dead wrong in Vietnam. And they were giving and for that matter, the great majority of Johnson's civilian advisors were giving him the same advice, advisors that he'd inherited from President Kennedy. All dead wrong. So you have to resist pressures like that. I am sure in his heart Obama doesn't want to get into a major thing.
No, I'm sure he doesn't.
You just know he doesn't.
Yeah.
You just know that trip to Dover and Delaware, to the trip down to Fort Hood, the trip to Arlington, and all those reflect a man deeply concerned about the deaths he's going to cause. And I just hope let me tell you one fact that just drives me crazy that more Americans don't know. In Vietnam, soldiers only had to serve 1 year.
Hmm.
Now we're sending these poor guys to 3-4 tours of not 1 year, but of 15 to 18 months each.
Mm-hmm.
So you just think from a human standpoint. You're in one of these dangerous places. You've been shot at, seen your comrades blown apart, and you're flying out of there the first, and you think, well, at last, I'm free of this. I'm going to go home to my family. I've done my service. I've made my sacrifice for my country. And then you get home, and a couple months they say, hey, you got to go back.
Right.
And then it happens again.
Awful.
And then they say, hey, you got to go back.
Mm.
And then they say, the Army needs more mental health professionals. Well, what the Army needs is to stop sending these guys repeatedly, and then they wouldn't need all those
mental health professionals
to counsel them to be sane, even though they were told repeatedly to risk their lives for marginal causes.
Point well taken. Chris from Madison, hi.
Good morning, and good morning, Mr. Peters. I've enjoyed following you for quite a few years.
Oh, well, thank you.
Certainly. And apropos of what you were talking about, you've been talked about many provocative things, but when you're talking about over-reliance on intellectuals, I'm just reminded that Robert Graves, the poet and the novelist, once said that a lot of brilliant people often aren't very smart. That's something I've noticed, and it's something I've really taken into account. The reason I called, however, is I remember that back in the 80s when you were at the helm of the Washington Monthly, you wrote about neoliberalism.
Yes, right.
And of course, you were playing off the term neoconservatism.
Right, right. Right,
and you embraced the term neoliberalism very much. Now I've noticed that both terms have changed. They've had kind of a definition drift.
It's depressing terribly in case of neoliberalism. It came to mean things that some of the exact opposite of what I meant. But anyway, go ahead. Excuse me for interrupting you.
No, you didn't. Actually, that's pretty much what I wanted to do is see how you felt, because neoliberalism is a very dismissive term used nowadays by lefties.
Right.
I think to talk about people who are super a free market that, as far as I can tell, are also conservative to the core.
Right. Oh, I'm glad you noticed it, but the new editor of the Monthly a couple of years ago, he took pity on what had happened to Neil Liber, and he got one of these kids who had been attacking making all these naughty remarks about neoliberalism to come and interview me and find out what I actually meant by it, and the kid was astonished because in many ways I was more liberal than he was. Neoliberalism was at its heart the defense of the spirit of liberalism against the sellout of the unconscious sellout of liberal ideas that had come with the kind of pull up the ladder thing that the unions were first guilty of when they asked for wage increases that were actually hurting the and benefit increases that were actually hurting the industry they were in. But the seniors are another example. My fellow seniors now, you could not believe how many of them are more concerned about keeping any tampering with their Medicare, anything that might threaten their Medicare or reform their Medicare, even though it might help bring about health care for all the poor people in the country who don't have it. So if that kind of pull up the ladderism just drove me crazy. But another great example was having the Social Security tax fall heaviest on the working people, which just has always seemed to me to be absolutely crazy, and that still exists. Obama spoke up about it during the campaign, and you notice his first stimulus money was that the tax break in his first stimulus was designed to somewhat alleviate that problem, but it's still a major, major scandal how high a percentage of the taxes in this country are paid, how high a percentage of the tax burden is borne by the people, the working people.
Another thing that you wrote about, and people don't remember this at all, Charlie, is our greatest prosperity has come in periods when the top tax rates have been 70% or more. 70%.
Oh, God bless you for remembering that. And I don't think anybody has written about that except me. It was my memory. So finally, I got some help and I did research, and I found that the only 4 years where unemployment has gone below 4%, the only 4 years since World War II, the only 4 years where unemployment has gone below 4%. Was when the top tax rate was 70% or higher, and now the top tax rate is just 35%. So, and yet these Republicans are moaning and groaning about, oh my God, we're taxed to death. And
thanks, Chris, for your call. Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for your guest. Would I be able to ask Mr. Peters, since he has been in a position to observe this type of thing, how it became acceptable to essentially relay pre-cooked talking points as opinion in the mainstream press. And I'm not talking about our friends on cable television, but, you know, the major newspapers, this adoption of what is essentially a agenda rather than eschewing dogma and ideology. You were supposed to be able to make original observations and use analysis in an earlier age, if I'm correct. So thank you.
Well, that's the original thought is rare, and certainly very rare today. But the depressing thing about most Washington opinion is how predictable what's said today is each day is going to be, and how after it's first said in the day, how then it gets repeated and repeated all through the day, and picked up and becomes part of the conventional wisdom. So I deeply sympathize with your concern.
Thanks very much for the call. You'd think we'd get bored of it after a while, wouldn't you, or know what's going on?
Well, I think the terrible thing now is you not only need good analysis, but you need to combine with the good analysis, you need depth reporting to gather the facts that are sometimes you have relatively difficult situations where you need a lot of fact gathering to find out what's really going on, and instead you have all of this opinion on the combination of cable news and the internet has been a tragedy for thought and for depth reporting. So both from the analyst standpoint of analysis and from the standpoint of depth reporting, the whole value is placed on quick one liner, the quick observation that sounds smart,
right?
So really and truly, in the press now, the depth reporting, you're down to just the New York Times and a few other sources where you get depth reporting, a few magazines and the Times and the Washington Post, a great newspaper, but it has gone downhill some in terms of the staffing. And the ability to do that kind of reporting, the papers that you used to rely on, like the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Miami Herald, the San Jose Mercury News, they're shadows of their former selves.
Yes, they are.
It's really, really sad, and I don't think anything concerns me more about. Journalism and the information, the whole information system of the American democratic system, than this breakdown of this precipitous decline of depth reporting.
And where does all of that go? Does something replace it? The internet gets better. There's more reporting, or what do you see?
Well, you get is more opinion, and the opinion just gets more extreme. I think the way these guys don't make a success by having better thought, but by being more extreme. So it's not by supplying more information, but it's by the more extreme view that captures attention. So you look at most of Fox. And it's just shocking. And I must say, as liberal as I am, there's sometimes on MSNBC when you go through the 4 hour or 4 liberal hours in the evening, and you think, my God, by 11 o'clock, I've heard that a good many times.
Yes, exactly. I know how true. The same thing.
Even though I tend to be sympathetic most of the time, I get a little suspicious when I've heard the same thing over and over.
Let's go to Randy from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Randy.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, how are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in northern Minnesota. Anyway, my thing is what he was saying about the drug thing and the prescriptions and all that's going on. It seems like they have a pill for everything these days.
Yeah.
And a lot of the side effects are worse than the symptoms, worse than the regular problem. But anyway, what I was going to say is my daughter was put on Ritalin when she was very young.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife and I were divorced, and I didn't like it in those days. Well, being the fact that she was on that stuff, when she got older, she couldn't get it anymore because, of course, her insurance wouldn't cover it, and she resorted to meth.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
And she became a meth addict.
Ooh.
And anyway, my grandkids were taken away from her a year ago. And my grandson is a normal little five-year-old boy. My granddaughter has no real problems. My grandson's a normal little energetic five-year-old boy. They get into mischief. They run, they jump, they do whatever. And they want to put him on that.
Oh,
and
no.
I am
no.
And I am totally against it.
I totally sympathize with you. I you know, you never you always hesitate to comment on a possible medical case, but I would say at least 80% of the time in my experience, that drug in particular has been not good.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Randy, for your call. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Charlie Peters. He is the founding editor and the former editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. Started over 40 years ago on a shoestring budget and a very small staff. He created a small but very influential political magazine. We're talking about a number of issues here. The president, the influences on the president in terms of Wall Street and generals and decisions that he has to make and who's pressuring him to go one way or the other. We're looking at the drug industry that Charlie wrote about in his Tilting at Windmills column, the most recent column. I mean, here's something. Talk about things that are people don't think very much about. He has a piece on Judge Roberts, John Roberts, in which he says that he's beginning to really dislike Chief Justice John Roberts, and he will tell you why in just a moment. We have some lines open. We're also talking about Gitmo detainees, about a maximum security prison in Illinois, about a civil trial in New York, and about health care reform. You name it, they're well, you can name other subjects, too. We're happy to talk to you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul & Mary is our guest, our number two of the program today. Just a couple things I want to remind you of. One is that we're on Facebook now, which is some of us are starting to have a lot of fun with this. So if you go to WPR.org and look at Kathleen Dunn, hit on that and then get to Facebook, become a fan, and you can do that, and we can talk, because Charlie says some interesting things that I'll be commenting on today, and I think you may want to do that as well. 800-486-8655 is the number, and the email address here is talk@WPR.org. Charlie, why are you beginning to really dislike Chief Justice John Roberts?
Because his conservatism is showing signs of being inhuman.
Hmm.
And there's an example. I can't even remember it now. If you've got the issue in front of you, just read that little example I gave in that issue of an inhuman decision.
DNA testing is what it's about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which has proved that 241 convicts were not guilty of the crimes for which they were imprisoned. Three states don't require DNA testing at all. Others limit its use. Roberts, you say, put states' rights ahead of human rights and is displaying a cold, cold heart.
Right, right. And I think, why not? If the guy is innocent, why don't you want him to get off? Why would you put states' rights, abstract principle like that ahead of the human right of the innocent person to get off?
Hmm.
I mean, it's that kind of rigid of conservatism that drives me crazy. And it is inhuman.
Our next caller is Jared from Black River Falls. Hi, Jared.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just wanted to call in response to the comments on the interest or on taxes. You know, we're in the country right now, we got a 10% unemployment rate and growing. And, you know, this just seems to me as, you know, I've been around for a while, too. I remember what it was like to live during the Carter era when interest rates and inflation was going through the roof and you had an 18% interest rate on a mortgage loan. And I'm in business, and a lot of people I work with and associates that I work with, they are not investing in new jobs. They're too fearful and scared of what the future has to bring. And when you get these guys, they start talking about raising the interest rate. They just have no economic common sense at all. The fact of the matter is that over 95% of the bills in this country are paid by the people in 1% tax bracket. And, you know, I think there should be tax relief, you know, throughout the whole system. And you know what? Another thing, millions of Americans don't pay taxes whatsoever. And to put the whole burden on the people that are creating jobs is just putting, you know, is this going to kill the economy? And you're going to look at Jimmy Carter number two in Obama. Thank you.
All right, Charlie.
You have to remember you had high taxes under Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower and John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and all when there was nearly full employment. And those were during those years that were the only times where the unemployment actually got below 4%. The taxes were always, the top tax rate was always over 70%. So you, the point is, you can tax the very rich, and it's not going to hurt prosperity at all. We had our greatest prosperity when we had the highest taxes on those guys. To me, the cruel tax is that payroll tax that bears so heavily on the working man.
Tell me something new about Lyndon Johnson.
Well, it's hard to say there's anything new because he's what I did get from the book. I had been anti-war at the time. But I'd always look back on the war as a terrible mistake. But you do get recalling now the feel of the time, and I was here during that time, and the pressures on him were so enormous to make what now seemed to be the terrible mistakes he made in Vietnam. The public opinion was like 70% behind the Vietnam policy, well through 1966. The great troop escalation happened in 1965, with all the generals supporting it. All of Johnson's advisors, except George Buckle, supported it. And Senator Mike Mansfield, everybody else said, go ahead. You've got to do it. It's the only thing. It's the only thing that will prevent Southeast Asia from collapsing to communism. All that was the respectable line. So you realize the poor guy, you have much more sympathy for him. And, of course, you end up with tremendous admiration, and particularly looking at now how hard it is to get a bill through Congress.
Right.
His amazing ability.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, the voting rights, the reason that Barack Obama is president today is because of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and that was Lyndon Johnson that got that bill through.
Yeah.
And finally, he finally made Abraham Lincoln's promise come true. The African Americans actually got political power through the Voting Rights Act,
yeah,
of 1965.
You know, one of the things, and be you Democratic or Republican, yeah, Charlie, it is such a pleasure to hear the President of the United States give a speech right now, isn't it? This guy can talk. He can talk.
And poor Lyndon could not.
No.
and then I think that it was a sad contrast from Jack Kennedy to
yes,
Lyndon. And well, you know, the same people now. If history has been rewritten so that Harry Truman is now a great hero, and in many ways he was. But back at the time, people forgot. There was this general terrible disillusionment with Truman that was because compared with Franklin Roosevelt speaking on the radio, it was
right.
just pathetic, you know.
Right.
It was just pathetic, and it was the same with Johnson and Obama. I think Obama is the best ever.
Mm-hmm.
He's
darn good.
He is a great speaker, and sometimes I'm afraid they a little overusing, but because it's unfortunate that there's no other administration spokesman. Even 25% is compelling.
Yes.
So that's so you can see why they are tempted to trot him out at every minute. But I do think sometimes there's a little overexposure.
Gary from Fitchburg. Hello, Gary. Oh, Gary, you hung up. That's too bad. Yeah, we go to Gertrude from West Bend. Hi, Gertrude.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so excited about this speaker because he's made me feel like a genius. I said for years that when the deficit was getting so big because we were spending for the Iraq War and not raising taxes.
Right.
This is insane. I'm old,
right.
And I lived through World War II,
right.
And remember that we bought stamps,
right,
bonds, and we can't, you know, to support the war.
Right,
you can't keep spending and not pay for it in some way. And the other thing I have said for years: why do they let drug companies advertise? Why are the expenses of the drugs going up because of those ads? It drives me crazy.
I have to tell you a story about World War II. In 1943, you know, the Republican, who was then still the leader of the Republican Party, Wendell Willkie, who led the ticket, Republican ticket in 1940, Roosevelt was all the way to raising the top tax rate to 90%. And Willkie criticized him for not raising taxes more. We're in this war. We've got to pay for what we're doing. Can you imagine? Can you imagine in your wildest imagination thinking of Republicans saying such a thing today?
What can we do about it? I felt these things for years, but I see nothing in the general public going in the direction of paying or feeling serious about our problems and really doing something about it. And I write letters, but I try to support Obama and in the little way that a retiree can, but I really feel I'm talking to the wind.
Well, I think the terrible problem in life is when you feel the way you do, and I do, obviously, that we share some feelings, often you're damn near talking to the wind. But occasionally, you reach out and you touch somebody and you get somebody excited, so you always have to keep trying. You always have to keep trying. I'm 83, and I've never give up. Never give up. Keep trying. That's the only way to live.
Hmm. Thanks, Gertrude, for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Ed from Wausau. Hi.
Hi. Charlie, you opened the program talking about Rahm Emanuel and the drug companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Late July and early August, when Senate and Congress were just going out, John Connors was invited to the National Press Club, and his meeting was cut short when it was announced that he had to go back for a vote. And he started to walk away from the podium, and one of the reporters shouted out, what about your single payer? And he stopped, dead stop, walked back to the podium, looked at the camera, and just said, Rahm Emanuel. They asked, and my question is Rahm Emanuel gaining as much power as Karl Rove had under the Bush administration?
I don't know. I doubt that. I think that kind of inside political power is probably shared with and that Axelrod probably still has more, And also that woman, I've forgotten her name.
Valerie Jarrett?
Yeah. She is, it's funny, within margins, she is very influential and with the president. And but I think Axelrod probably still, as a political voice, has probably the most power. But Emanuel, as the guy, the chief of staff, always has a lot of power, and also as the guy who's they rely on to get things through Congress. So when you've got your key congressional operative telling you some of the things that you've got to do, you tend to listen to him.
And on that note, we have to end, Charlie. We're out of time. You were a pleasure. Please join us again. Thank you.
Okay, it was fun.
Thank you. Charlie Peters, founding editor of the Washington Monthly, our guest for All Things Political. He still writes Tilting at Windmills, which you can find online. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and for on-air production. We'll return.